Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
From the blackest corners of your mind, they call, pulling you deep into shadow, twisting your senses, keeping you from sleep. It's time to face your darkest fears. This is Tales to Terrify.
Good evening, children of the night, and welcome. This is fiction editor Meredith Morgenstern. I'm excited to bring you Tales to Terrify's Women in Horror Month 2024 with a celebration of women in horror podcasting. The ladies you'll meet this month are all fascinating contributors to the horror dialogue. I'm a personal fan of each one of these podcasts and chose them specifically for how much I love them and what they do for the horror community. So, whether you like horror movies, books, short stories, or all of the above, like me, keep listening. You know when you sit around with your friends and talk about your favorite horror movies and everyone gets really into it, and pretty soon you've all fallen down a rabbit hole and you spend the next few weeks looking up essays and trivia about the movie you just saw and sending links to each other with lots of exclamation points? That's this podcast, Good Morning Nancy, hosted by Gracie and Abby, who have been best friends, and I quote, since forever. And that energy comes through in every episode they do, dissecting every second of a particular horror movie in a way only true fans can do. Abby's a psychology major, so she loves digging deep into the relationship between the human psyche and horror. As experienced horror fans know, that's a rich subject to dive into. But Abby makes it so easy to understand. Gracie is the manifestation of a haunted Shirley Jackson character mixed with a plucky Disney heroine who understands that horror really is a woman's genre. Together, they absolutely get our need to nitpick, ponder, and otherwise obsess over every tiny detail in a horror movie. My favorite part about the podcast is how many indie and obscure horror movies I've been introduced to thanks to Abby and Gracie. No matter how well-versed you think you are in horror films, I promise they have at least one you've never heard of, but really must watch. Now, grab a pencil and paper, children of the night, because the ladies of Good Morning Nancy have recommendations for days. Gracie loves Slumber Party Massacre, for starters, and honestly, who doesn't? And want you to sink your teeth into movies and books by Nia DaCosta, Diablo Cody, Karen Kusama, Mary Harron, Tanana Reeve Du, Jane Schoenburn, Jennifer Kent, and her absolute favorite, Millicent Patrick. From Abby, we get Anna Lily Amirpour, I Love a Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, and Catherine Bigelow's Near Dark. There's a lot of heavy hitters in those recs, and that's why I love this podcast. So celebrate women in horror all year long with this super fun podcast, Good Morning Nancy. Of course, do it after you survive tonight's stories. And thank you once again, Gracie and Abby. Our first story for the evening comes from Emily J. Weisenberger. Emily J. Weisenberger is from Virginia. In an attempt to understand people, she collected 2 degrees in anthropology before taking up fiction writing. Her publications include short stories in L'Esprit Literary Review, The Vanishing Point, and Unreal Politic. Children of the Night, join me for Emily J. Weisenberger's The Prairie's Song, a Tales to Terrify original.
Leland first spied his homestead, a few miles out. There was nothing between him and his claim except a flat expanse of waist-high grasses. Some of the grasses were topped in fur, like tiny horse manes, or in prickly white flowers, but most were plain to look at, and a nauseating greenish-brown. The sky splayed above, palest blue and huge. The house, a brown and singular speck, like the last tooth in an old-timer's jaw, stood still in the tide of swaying prairie grasses. Leland's papers said his homestead was 160 acres of uncultivated land and one sod-built house, built and abandoned in the same year by some sad sack giver-upper. 5 years in this soddy, 5 years greening the ground, and the tract would be Leland's to claim, as the law of the United States of America declared. He would prove Justicia wrong, his bleeding heart sister, and those silly wastrels she called friends. It was a dead, dull walk once he'd spotted the house. All of Kansas had been a dead, dull walk. But at least before today, he hadn't been alone. It had been like a daily parade, the Bonnie Castles in front with the guns, then Leland, and that family of seven and their 2 wagons, the Lefevers, behind. They'd gone northward this morning, and Leland was carrying on alone, except for his mule. So today, he heard no jangling harnesses, no crying children, no hymns or chants or giggling. The only sound was air rustling through the prairie grasses. "It's not yours to claim," Justicia had said, the day he'd signed his name on the roll next to the Bonnie Castles and the Lefevers. "You should let the prairie be." He'd bought his mule the next day. Leland was a settler in service of his country. He walked as the crow flies toward his homestead. He parted the grass like Moses parting the sea, his mule following behind. From the grasses to his left, a jackrabbit thunked out. It landed heavily on Leland's booted feet. "Good God!" Leland shouted and fell back. The jackrabbit turned tail and leapt away on skeletal legs. Even with its unnaturally long ears, lean like devil horns, Leland could spot no more hint of it. It disappeared within that sea of grasses, here and gone. The swaying prairie hid all but grass. Leland marched onward, his heart thumping an uneasy beat. The prairie grasses whistled from here to heaven, incessant-like. The sun passed across the white dome of sky, hit him at the top of his head like a beam from on high, and the damn soddy never got bigger. He began to grumble each time his overburdened mule stumbled behind him. He yanked on its harness, too hard, but he almost wished the mule would complain, make some noise to cover up the whistling. He yanked again. The beast's lumbering head swung, and it tripped over its own hooves, but made no sound. Leland had never noticed the noise of the prairie grasses before today, not while he was with the company of his fellow chattering patriots. The grasses swayed and shushed and whistled, though from what? The wind wasn't half strong enough to flap the hair free beneath his cap. The constant whistle might have been tolerable if it were predictable, but it wasn't. It was pitched like a hog's dying scream after you stuck it, and then like a child's, and then like a demon from fairy tales. He had the unholy thought that something played the grasses from within to make them whistle the eerie rhythm. He shook his head. He dug a finger into each ear and trudged on. It was well past noon when Leland yanked on his mule and threw down its pack. The mule carried his provisions, iron tools and seed, oil, and a Bible. Leland's fingers found a warm knot of beeswax pressed between paper and cherished for future candles. He jabbed it into his ears, laid down on a bed of rough grasses, slapped his cap across his face, and took to resting his eyes. "Not yours to take." Leland turned his head and spit into the flattened grass. "Not according to the United States of America." On the day he set out from Charlottesville, Justicia and her lazing friends were hiding in the back shed, hand-copying something they'd called a manifesto. Leland told their father as soon as he caught wind of it, of course, and father had burned the pamphlets, rightly so. Anti-patriotic drivel was a waste of good paper. "The Indians are all gone," Leland told her, while he held her back and she scratched and glared something fierce. "And they left the land in need of some civilizing. I'm doing my duty." Now, with 1,000 miles under his feet, Leland knew all gone was not total truth. Not that he'd ever give Justicia the satisfaction of capitulating. Despite Silas Bonnycastle's jaw-clenching habit to shoot at the sky whenever an Indian came close, the Indians' marks were everywhere. Trails led Leland to blackberry patches, traps offered up free dinner, and unfamiliar songs billowed at night from the outskirts of Indian towns. When he heard the people singing and percussing, he almost felt like home. Leland squirmed where he lay. The sun was hot on his face, even through his cap. He fanned himself with it. A jackrabbit leapt from the grasses into Leland's flattened trail. Was it the same beast? Leland stared, mesmerized by its devilish ears for a single frozen second before the jackrabbit thunked onto his chest. Leland screamed and flailed. He felt its enormous feet and its claws dig into his skin, and then it was springing away, back into the swaying brown grass. Leland swore to the Almighty, swore at those accursed hares with their shifty ears and eyes like tomb beetles. He abandoned his bed and marched onward. The beeswax made the whistling quieter, but did not make it more tolerable. It felt like the muffled song came from behind Leland, then to the side, then behind again. He led his mule and whipped his head back and forth. He shook his head. What would Justicia say if she were here to see his struggle now? No. Leland would be no weakling, no giver-upper. He forced himself to glare straight ahead at his soddy and his new tract of land. This was his domain now. He practically owned it. He'd clear the grasses, dig their roots up, burn them to smoke. No more whistling after that. No more surprised devil rabbits. Finally, Leland reached the soddy. He unclipped the mule from its burden and harness. He undid the scarf around his neck, wiped his forehead, and fanned himself with his cap while he walked a slow circle around the outside of his new homestead. There was one doorway and one window, both with wooden shutters, no glass. It was squat, made of dirt, and a square. He could cross one wall in three strides. The view from each side of the house was exactly the same. The flat prairie stretched outward. The white sky. Was there no blue out west? Was endless and empty, even of clouds. It was as if the prairie went on and on to the end of the world. Leland squinted against the empty, unbroken land, its drained sky, its unpredictable song. He clapped his hands over his ears. He escaped inside the soddy and shut the door behind. The soddy was dark and smelled of dried dirt, like dust swiped from the top of a bureau. There were two pieces of furniture, a straw mattress, pest chewed and molting on the floor, and a chair facing the soddy's inner wall. It was a wooden rocking chair, well-oiled and standing in deep divots that were cut into the dirt floor. The window was to its back. Leland fell into the rocking chair. He gripped the arms and was surprised when his thumbs found well-worn grooves on either side. They were perfectly placed, so he rubbed them back and forth and felt almost soothed, but stopped when he had the terrible thought. Was he rubbing the wood grain to the rhythm of the singing grasses? He fled back outside and pressed his back against the outer dirt wall. The Inkling's fear, those he'd held at bay during his 1,000-mile walk with this group, those that had grown today as he set out alone and had risen unchecked from that first damned jackrabbit, could be held back no more. The grasses waved. The prairie's song rose loud, louder. The slicing prairie air choked in Leland's throat. The prairie crashed open under a stampede of jackrabbits. How angry he was to be made to fear. It wasn't right. It was not right. This was his land. Like the demon underlings of the ever-plotting devil, the jackrabbits came all at once, and they came all together. From the left, the right, straight ahead, from hell, and they made for the soddy, beelining for Leland's fearing body. No, Leland whispered. The horde flattened the still singing grasses with their thumping feet. No! Leland stamped his own feet. He would not scamper back to Virginia, a failed homesteader. He would not shrink into a little boy under Justicia's knowing gaze, his father's disappointed silence. This is my land! The black eyes of the jackrabbit sparkled like crystal voids. They bounded in rhythm to the rushing grasses. He stepped forward. Like a father, before he whips his children into shape, Leland shouted abuse at the scuttling jackrabbits. They came anyway, a stampede across his claim. Leland pulled off his hat and smacked and swiped as the first line of beasts fell upon him. He held his footing as claws ripped at his feet, his legs. He snarled. He could take them and more to defend his stake. The first line of jackrabbits bounded past him, continuing their flight across the endless prairie. There was a moment of pause. Leland dug his feet into the ground. A second line of jackrabbits leapt at him, their numbers double, triple the first. They jumped upon their fellows to reach for his chest, his face. He shrieked and fought, swinging punches and kicks, and he toppled. They stamped him down into the grasses. The song whipped at his ears. More jackrabbits came, and more. Leland squirmed, coughed for air, swallowed coarse hair and soil, tasted blood. Claws sliced into his face, his legs. A rib cracked. Another. Leland moaned and cowered, his back twisted into the dirt. He screamed at the singing prairie as he cowered upon its grasses. He screamed and screamed as the jackrabbit stamped upon him. The pounding thumps of two big feet on his chest slowed. He screamed and hollered until they stopped. The jackrabbit streamed past him, left the soddy behind. Leland hobbled upright to watch hundreds of jackrabbits bound away. Their whip-like ears bopped. Had the jackrabbits spared him? Had the prairie decided to let him live? Leland considered retreating inside his soddy, cowed and dirty, servant to the prairie he'd come to claim. A gash in his forehead dripped blood into Leland's eyes. No. He'd catch the jackrabbits. He'd catch them and skin them all. Then he'd crush every blade of grass until the prairie bent toward him, lay itself down for him to walk upon. Leland snarled and began a limping run toward the retreating jackrabbits. The grass smacked at his wounds. He shrieked at the prairie, at its disobedience. Blood dripped from his body as he made chase. The waving song intensified. The grasses danced and twirled. The white sky shifted to gray and then to black. Leland could see no more than shifting shapes of darkness, but still he chased and he chased. The grasses whooshed, and the prairie sang for whom it claimed. "Mine!" he screamed at it. "Mine!" His voice cracked, his throat burned. "Mine!" His steps stuttered. He was so thirsty, but he shrieked wordlessly, unceasingly. He shrieked to his sister, to the jackrabbits, the prairie, to those he would make submit. He ran away across the dark, endless plain. He ran farther and farther. The prairie folded Leland's screams into its everlasting song. It took his screams, and now it takes his body, too.
That was Emily J. Weisenberger's The Prairie's Song, as read by Rish Outfield. Rish Outfield is a writer, voice actor, and podcaster. He is the co-host of the Dune Steve audio fiction magazine and his own show, The Rish Outcast. He likes horror, Star Wars, and girls with glasses, and there's no job he cannot be fired from, at least not yet. Thank you, Rish.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Our second tale tonight comes from Casey Griffint. Casey Griffint is an award-winning author based in Southern California who writes horror, fantasy, science fiction, and Weird West stories for podcasts, anthologies, and magazines. Her tales have appeared in Andromeda Spaceways magazine, Unnerving magazine, Cosmic Horror Monthly, Dark Matter magazine, The Lovecraft E-zine, and many others. In addition to a horror historic novel called Melinda West Monster Gunslinger, she has written for dozens of anthologies. For details, visit www.caseygriffint.com. Now listen with me, children of the night, to Casey Griffin's Unrest, first published in Dancing in the Shadows, a tribute to Anne Rice, May 2022.
The car rolls to a stop, positioned squarely in front of the Holland Cemetery gates, as though it's a natural parking spot. Rows of hills studded with tombstones like goosebumps rise behind the gate. I scrutinize Henry's sharp cheekbones in the twilight from the passenger seat. I know about the switchblade tucked inside his pocket, probably icy against his thigh through the fabric. I smooth my hands over my tights, trying to ignore the cemetery's presence, watchful as a disapproving parent wondering what's taking so long for me to come inside. Sorry, Lotta baby, we're out of gas. Henry shrugs. It's true, this I know. I also know he's planned it. His breath is quickening, his back has straightened, like a hunter that just caught a whiff of potential prey. What should we do now? I say in preen, the good girlfriend. Deep in my core, I hum at the nearness to the cemetery, desperate for me to come inside. But I stuff those feelings down. Some things can't be rushed. And a part of me hopes maybe this time will be different. Walk, I guess. We'll have to cut through the cemetery. Henry shrugs, giving me a lopsided grin under his sandy hair. Attentive, relaxed, charismatic. I never thought I would have enjoyed our week together so much. I had been, for the first time alive, humming along to street music as we snuggled on a bench, watching the first snowfall swirl past the blur of moonlight and into his hair, scorching my tongue on fresh blazed mozzarella from the stone oven pizza place nearby, hearing the squeals of children tearing through the park, all of it razor sharp, technicolored, and threading through each memory, Henry's warm embrace like a drug I can't get enough of. As we get out of the car, I sneak a look at his face, which is a mask expertly concealing the storm within. Most people don't see it, but I am acutely aware of the anger that makes up every fiber of his being. We file through the small, broken, gated door next to the cemetery sign, and shame wells in me. How could I have fallen for such a monster? Because you're a monster too, something whispers back. So it's safe here, right? I say casually. A dozen crows watch from a scraggly tree. The closest one tilts its head, fixes its beady eyes on me. I will it to be silent. Henry drinks up my naivete. He thinks I'm new to town and I don't know better. Of course, just us and the birds. He sips his vest and slugs an arm across my shoulders. The heat diffuses through my back, across my throat, and down my chest, awakening flesh held together by icy winds, midnight moons, and the soft sobbing of someone always out of reach. It's almost time. The hopelessness hangs like a fog here. I breathe it in. Despair is what the dead infuse in the graveyard. This is to be expected. But nipping at the corners of the gloom is something that cannot remain. The thing I'm here to fix. The thing that Henry brings. Rage. Hey, let's stop up here, Henry says as we bound up the next hill. Don't, I think. But he continues. You know, I'm sort of glad we had a chance to walk through here. There's something I want to tell you. Henry's voice is too eager. The tombstones lean in, an audience straining to hear. The ground below me grumbles, restless. Soon, I tell it, half-heartedly. We finally reach the spot. The hill looks unremarkable, but the wind blows a little icier here. The patches of dirty snow never seem to melt. Here memories bubble like an infected cyst. I look down at my muddy boots, thinking of all the women who have stood in this place before. Their screams still reverberate in the ground, tearing at any stitches the graveyard tries and fails to bind time and time again. Lotta, babe, I know it's early in our relationship, but I really feel, like I love you. Is that crazy? Henry stops and spins toward me, framed by two looming blocks of marble and slate, ineligible in the dark air. He trails a finger along my cheek, making me shiver and waver. His eyes are intent. He means it, in his twisted definition of love. Even though I have become what would please him, the fact that he chooses me for his own makes my breath catch. I love you too. I suck in the air, willing its coldness to shock some sense into me. Clouds flow like ink above us. Henry's eyes are too bright. His love for me has reached a tipping point, spilling into his sacred pain. I can almost feel it there, the beating core at his center that drew me to him. It feels like a sack of bones hardened into obsidian shards, tucked into a tiny black hole where his heart should be. I got you this. Henry holds up a locket, a simple golden heart punctured with a garnet. I know he's given the same to girls before me. 6 so far, all in their early 20s, all with longish hair, a way of talking that is more sighing and a fondness for skirts. All missing now. Their remains stuffed under his favorite tomb, where wilting wildflowers grow along the cracked limestone. I nod, bracing for the inevitable, and remind myself I'm here to do one job. Remember what he is, I tell myself. What you are. We're both creatures of anguish, brought together by fate, neither of us deserving of love. Still, I hesitate. I'm bound to him. I am who I am because of his hate and sadness. But maybe there's a chance for us to both be more. If he changes now, we can continue beyond the graveyard gates to live. Thank you. It's beautiful, I say, and I mean it. He beams while I fasten the necklace. Now, the cemetery urges. I ignore it, containing myself for just a little longer. The graveyard hisses in anger. My hope crashes when I see how Henry's gaze is glassy, the look of someone in the full throes of their psychosis. It's like a switch has been thrown. How about a kiss? His breathing is faster now, his posture too taut. I hesitate, remembering the brush of his lips to mine, the jolt of sweet electricity that runs through my mouth. Even though I'm expecting it, I'm not ready for how fast he is as the knife comes out, how deftly he presses it to my neck. I try to pull back, but his other hand is expertly wrapped around the back of my shoulder. Don't fight it, Lotta, he says, almost monotone as if he's been coerced into auditioning for a play. He is measured, surgical, though he's panting. Henry, you don't have to do this, I gasp. I don't know what made him this way. Perhaps something in his brain needs rebalancing or some unspeakable childhood trauma broken beyond repair. But maybe if I say the right lines, I can untangle the knot of this sickness, pull the thread out of him. Then we can leave this place together. The crow's wings slice the darkness overhead, trying to get my attention. The winds moan in frustration. Please, I say. I know what you've done. You can stop it now. Henry's eyes darken, but he doesn't say anything. You find a way to bring all your girlfriends here, I continue. The petite woman with the fondness for purple eyeshadow and library books. The brunette in the homemade skirt and her grandmother's hand-me-down pearls. The blade is cold, but not as cold as my skin. And they all go missing afterwards. I didn't do anything, he says. But the lie breaks his fragile words, so he tries again. This time sounding like a whining child caught with a forbidden candy. I can't help it. I had seen it all before I became Lotta. Seen through the air and the trees and the stones, how cleanly he split open their necks. I had drowned as their blood soaked into our grass. I had howled with the winds as their bodies were stuffed into our grounds. Each of the fine gold links of each of the necklaces crushed underfoot, embedded into the earth like infected splinters. But really, it was the rage that had woken me. The girl's screams, entangled with his fury, had sunk deep into the earth, echoing again and again. So there was no rest, never any rest. Finally, the cemetery drew me up from the land, coalesced into Lada by the dead with a simple duty: to heal this scar, to rid us of the parasite that had soiled our hallowed dirt. It is my first time as a human, made up of the fragments of the dead's memories, traits, abilities. I am something the graveyard has constructed, birthed as a last desperate act to grant peace. "You have to stop coming here," I plead. "Let the dead rest. Say you will." Muscles spasm across Henry's face like an electric storm, and he shakes his head. "Why?" My voice is hoarse. "Of all places, why torment the dead with more death?"
"They're most afraid here."
He's so quiet I can barely hear him.
"Fear makes them most alive."
"Now, now, now," the graveyard is screaming. It can't wait. The ground rumbles and splits next to him, stretching into a chasm that is exactly his body length. A slab of granite emerges from the dirt, gleaming like a tooth. Henry looks over at the new gravestone, a frown deepening the lines along his mouth as he tries to make sense of it. His hands loosen a fraction of their strength and I yank away, pivoting free before he jabs the knife in response. He stares at me in astonishment before his jaw tightens. He expects me to run and is ready to chase. Instead, I reach out, both hands open. "Don't take this from me, from us," I beg. Everything in me recoils at the thought of the murdered bodies, their bones mangled on top of each other in their makeshift graves. But then I think of his arms, his eyes like lanterns, how his laughter sends shivers along my earlobe, my neck. "I want to stay, Lada, stay with you. I love you, even after all you've done," I say. "We could leave this place, start a new life." I'm not sure if the graveyard will allow it, but I sense it watching, waiting. If Henry never comes here again, maybe we can both be free. His face opens, and for a second, I can almost see what he could have been. His potential for kindness. His clever way of seeing patterns and articulating them as beautifully as a poet. It's all there. Almost concrete. A second later, the real Henry takes over. I draw back as I see the clumps of red fury like barbed hooks embedded into every piece of him, inseparable from his core. His face twists, snarling as he dives forward with the knife again. It nicks the edge of my necklace instead. The fragments of the gold chain twinkle in the moonlight, like half a dozen wishes extinguished suddenly. "My love is not enough," I sob aloud as the realization hits me, sharp like a piece of glass in my gut. "And he will never let the graveyard be." Now it really is time. I rise and shed my facade. It is disconcerting to be so big, so airy after the comfort of boundaries, the comfort of contained flesh. Now I cannot feel. I cannot leave. I can only serve. Henry's face gapes and then contorts into panic. "Lada! Lada!" Henry is screaming louder than all his victims together. His eyes bulge as he looks up at me. He stabs his knife into me again and again. I only feel tiny jolts like static electricity. I am between ethereal and solid now, made of white and gray gossamer loosely bound together in the rough conglomeration of the bones below.
Around my skeletal head stream threads that shimmer all the textures of his dead girlfriend's hair. A reminder to him. I scream at him for all the girls that can't. I scream at him for myself. For the chance to live that was so close but gone. The rage feels good. A release. I still feel love. Oh, and the sorrow. All raw, uncontained by human limits, even as some threads of Lotta still cling to me. Henry is trying to crawl away, bellowing like an animal. I float forward, cradle him in what approximates hands, emaciated branches of fingers. Time to rest, I say, my words a summoned wind. Maybe death would give him some respite, a chance to start again. I embrace him as gently as I can in my form, but he is writhing too much, and I accidentally crunch bones like sticks. His cries turn animal-like, wounded and afraid, and I blink back the memory of tears. I place him in the pit. He struggles, but the earth eagerly closes over him, smothering his frame. His hands strain out of the dirt, clawing at the air. I toss the broken necklace onto the mound, and a fissure of pain seems to cleave me in two. At least now we can heal, I think. Maybe I will be called forth again someday if the graveyard needs me. For now I grow more ephemeral, my matter curling into the branches, flitting into the crumbling brown dirt between straining earthworms and dung beetles. I'm unspooling. I try to hold on to the memory of warmth on a park bench, the feeling of laughter bubbling up in my throat, and the rush of food and music and snowflakes and clasped hands. My tears are condensed dew, shivering orbs on the matted grass. Henry's soul will release in a glittering cloud like shattered quartz. Traces of his rage will join the echo of the girl's screams, intermingling in the soil. Like everyone in the graveyard, hints remain of who they had been, sunk into the terrain like a stain. Henry's shouts are growing fainter now, muffled. It will be the last screams the graveyard hears.
That was Casey Griffin's Unrest, as read by Amanda Stribling. Amanda has recorded close to 150 books, give or take a chapter, and is in the industry by way of being completely obsessed with reading and audiobooks, while also having a flair and passion for performance. She has a natural Southern accent, but can also take you from savvy socialite to California girl to Southern belle faster than you can say, bless your heart. Thank you, Amanda.
Well, children of the night, the hour is late, and we've run out of tales to tell. For now. Tales to Terrify is made possible by the tremendous generosity of our supporters on Patreon and PayPal. Incredible fans like Lessel Baxter, Paul Belcher, Amanda Carrillo, Amanda Gottfried, and Orion D. Higra, whose generous support helps keep the lights on and flickering ominously. Not a supporter already? Head over to patreon.com/talestoterrify, where you'll find all kinds of perks, like ad-free episodes, bonus content, and one-of-a-kind collectibles and merch packs. Every dollar goes back into this show to make it as horrific as possible, and we appreciate it so much. Want another way to support the show that doesn't cost a cent? Head over to Podchaser, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating or review. You'll not only put an unnaturally wide smile on our faces, but help new listeners discover our terrifying tales, too.
Why not share your love of the show out in the world with some Tales to Terrify merch? TalesToTerrify.com/merch will take you to our TeePublic store, where we've got a great collection of creepy custom and curated designs, so you can show those around you just how twisted you truly are. Tales to Terrify is produced by Seth Williams, Meredith Morgenstern, Andrew Gibson, Crystal Hammond, Spencer Disparti, and myself, Drew Sebastini, with original theme by Nebulous Entertainment. Tales to Terrify is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Join us again next week as we search for unsettling truths with more Tales to Terrify.